Can a vaccine be used to prevent stomach ulcers?
An update on stroke therapy.
What about the relationship between citrus and the skin cancer, melanoma?
And another agent for obesity.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on July 3rd, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science System in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, it's the summer. It's almost July 4th. It seems almost unbelievable to me. So I think this one we need to examine first is, wow, what is the relationship between the consumption of citrus and the development of melanoma, the most deadly type of skin cancer? That's in the Journal of Clinical Oncology.
We've talked before about the fact that the incidence of melanoma has been increasing over the last 20 or 30 years, and there's a clear relationship between the formation of melanoma and exposure to sunlight or UV radiation. There's also some concern that exposure to certain carcinogens increase the risk as well. And one of the agents that is known to be a photocarcinogen are the compounds called sorolins or furocumarins. These are agents that we use to treat psoriasis, and that is the patients will take these orally, and it sensitizes the skin to the results of UV light. And we use it to treat psoriasis. But it also stimulates melanocytes, those are the cells that make melanin and are responsible for melanoma. And so the question is, for individuals that are exposed to dietary sorolins or furocumarins, does that increase the risk of melanoma as well? And a source of those is citrus fruits. So these authors used data from the Nurses Health Study that included almost 64,000 women and men from the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. And that included about 42,000 men that every 2 or 3 years gave dietary reports about what they were eating. They were followed for 24 to 26 years. And during that follow-up, there were about 1,800 cases of melanoma. When they correlated the ingestion of citrus fruits, it appeared that individuals that ate 1.6 servings or more per day increased the risk of melanoma by 36%.
Well, but there was also a rather weird finding in this, and that was consumption of whole fruits versus juice, and also which type of citrus people were consuming.
Right. And so I present this study to the listeners, not because I think the results are valid, but actually to talk about the study itself. First of all, these are just associations. The second thing is you look for consistency. Is it across all citrus fruits? And as you said, well, it looked like there was an association for grapefruits, but not grapefruit juice. And there was no association for oranges, but there was for orange juice. So that is internally inconsistent. And it really raises, in my mind, the issue of whether this is valid or not.
I think that that's an apt criticism. I would also, though, point out that there are some medications where we say to folks, hey, don't eat grapefruits when you're taking this medication, but we don't say anything about oranges, for example. So maybe there are significant differences in their composition.
And while that's true, one would expect the fruit and the juice of the same product to have similar results. There are other issues as well. At the minimum, it needs to be replicated in other studies.
Okay. Let's turn from here then to something else I think is really provocative. I served it up as, wow, can we take a vaccine approach to the prevention of stomach ulcers? That's in The Lancet, and it's a look at a vaccine for Helicobacter pylori, the causative agent of a lot of stomach ulcers.
So I'm going to abbreviate it as H. pylori, and it's a bacteria found in the stomach, in the lining of the stomach, and is one of the most common stomach or gastric pathogens. It affects more than half the world's population and is associated with stomach irritation, also called gastritis, with ulcers, peptic ulcers, even with stomach cancer. And in fact, this study that we're going to talk about came from China, and in China, there are more than 600 million individuals affected with H. pylori. This is such an important issue. The discovery of the pathogen was awarded a Nobel Prize in 2005. What the authors attempted to do was to develop an oral vaccine. And by the way, this has been going on for the last 25 years unsuccessfully. They fused two proteins, one from the H. pylori and one from E. coli, a common bacteria, who were able to get a very high level of protein that could be ingested orally and be active. Most of the oral proteins we take are inactivated, but they preceded this with a little antacid, gave this particular vaccine to kids between the ages of 6 and 15, and a year later assessed how many of these kids, which initially did not have infection, developed infection, and they compared it to placebo group. And what they showed was the vaccine was 72% effective at 1 year in preventing H. pylori infection. And kids that didn't have it and received either 3 doses of the vaccine over a month or 3 doses of placebo.
Really very fascinating. I'm so interested in this idea that an oral vaccine, which would presumably be digested in the stomach, was actually able to induce this kind of a response. Was there any antibody measurement?
You're exactly right. There was. It measured both immunoglobulin G and immunoglobulin A and showed there was a marked increase. So what happens is this antigen is taken up by the epithelium. There are cells there that are responsible for making the immunoglobulin. And by the way, there were no serious side effects associated with this.
So it sounds like we're going to need to catch these kids really early in order to be able to interrupt infection.
And that's why they tested it in kids. They had a small group of the kids in which they had continued follow-up, and it appeared to wane a little bit. So it may require a booster.
Very interesting. From here, why don't we turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, our ongoing story, the search for an effective drug therapy for obesity.
Let's take a step back. First of all, you'd like to prevent it. And we know that obesity is associated with adverse cardiovascular effects, increased risk of cancer, metabolic syndrome, diabetes. So for those individuals that are unable to address this with exercise or decreasing caloric intake, it would be nice if there were some pharmacologic agents, some drug that could help them do this. These particular authors studied a newer type of medication, oftentimes used to treat diabetes. This particular study was conducted over 56 weeks, a double-blind trial involving over 3,700 obese individuals who did not have diabetes, and they were prescribed placebo or this particular medication called liraglutide, in addition to receiving counseling on lifestyle modification. At the end of 1 year, what percentage of people in the placebo or the active drug group had lost at least 5% or 10% of their initial body weight? For those that received the medication, about two-thirds of them had lost at least 5% of their body weight, compared to about 27% in the placebo group. And 33% of the active drug takers lost 10% of their body weight, as compared to only 11% in the placebo group. And incidentally, also improved metabolic control as well.
But it also had significant gastrointestinal side effects.
That was the most commonly reported side effect. 94% of the individuals who had any side effects related to the GI tract were reported as mild or moderate in severity. And only about 6% of individuals actually had to withdraw from taking the medication as a result of these.
I suppose this is good news. It certainly is not a magic bullet, and it probably doesn't result in the significant weight loss that's really necessary to reduce all the risk factors related to obesity.
And there's no doubt about that, but it can be an adjunct to exercise and a healthier lifestyle.
An ongoing story, and that's where I'll leave that one. Finally, let's turn to circulation. What about preventing strokes?
So we're going to focus a little bit less on preventing strokes, Elizabeth, and more about treatment. This is an update from the American Heart Association dealing with the treatment of ischemic stroke. And the reason they updated it was there have been 8 really good trials recently that changed the paradigm of how we treat individuals that have an occlusive stroke, the clot that interferes with arterial blood flow to the brain. First of all, they confirmed that the earlier the treatment, the more likely you are to limit ongoing and persistent brain damage. That should involve the administration of a clot-busting medication as quickly as possible. Following that, treatment should ensue with what's called an endovascular stent. It's a self-expanding stent associated with a device that can actually retrieve some of the blood clots and help restore the circulation. And so it's now recommended for certain patients that have an acute ischemic stroke. Those that have had no significant disability before the stroke have received one of these thrombolytic agents. Those that have an occlusion, either in the internal carotid artery or the proximal, the early part of the middle cerebral artery, people over the age of 18, all these people have head imaging beforehand, have no permanent damage in over half the brain on the affected side, and those that can receive this therapy in under 6 hours.
And we, of course, reported on these particular devices and on their efficacy in helping people avoid the sequela of strokes. So that's terrific. One thing I noted about this particular update was that the window for the administration of TPA remains at 4.5 hours in order to maximize its benefits. We have seen other studies that show that that window is continuously being pushed. And also the intra-arterial administration of TPA is a strategy that's under investigation.
And there are some recommendations concerning those particular therapies as well in here. What I did want to stress is treat as early as possible. And by the way, Elizabeth, I gave you some wrong information, and this is actually published in Stroke, not in Circulation. That's my fault.
Thank you for that. I would finally just note that the best outcomes, of course, are achieved in regional centers that have great expertise and availability for these treatments to be employed as soon as possible. So for anybody who's listening to that, I would say, wow, if you think you have symptoms of a stroke, get yourself to one of those centers.
Absolutely. And there's a whole section dedicated to systems of stroke care in this update as well.
Excellent. On that note, I'm going to discuss the citrus relationship to melanoma this week on the blog. Wish everyone a wonderful and a safe, happy 4th of July weekend here in the U.S. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.